Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one of For the Record program number 766. Bob Dylan versus the Ustashee. This program is being recorded on December 22nd of the year 2013. For many years, we have been speaking about the Croatian Ustashi, that's U-S-T-A-C-H-I. You'll also hear it sometimes pronounced Ustashi, and you'll also see it spelled U-S-T-A-S-H-I or E. They were the brutal German puppets who ruled Croatia during World War II and became notorious even in fascist circles for their brutality and the bloodiness and enthusiasm with which they slaughtered not only Jews and communists, but also Serbs and Romani or Gypsies, as they are sometimes known. Recently, the Ustashi came back into public focus in part because of a comment that Bob Dylan made in a Rolling Stone article. The following is from the New York Times of December 3rd of 2013. Bob Dylan charged with inciting hate, unquote, under French law. It's by Alan Kozin, capital K-O-Z-I-N-N, reads in part, to people who follow the pronouncements of Bob Dylan, his comment in a Rolling Stone interview in September of 2012 suggesting that American blacks could sense whether whites have slave master blood, quote, just like Jews can sense Nazi blood and the Serbs can sense Croatian blood, unquote, may have seemed just a sort of vaporously impressionistic, emotionally pointed kind of thing that Mr. Dylan has been known to say for decades. But through the representative council of the Croatian community and institutions in France, an organization that looks after the interests of France's 30,000 Croatians, those were fighting words. Now they have led to Mr. Dylan, who built his early career singing songs that denounced racism, being charged under a French law prohibiting, quote, public insult and inciting hate, unquote. On Tuesday, Agnès Thibault-Lecuivre, a spokeswoman for the prosecutor's office in Paris, told the AP that the French government had filed preliminary charges. Skipping down, the French government must have known that the charges were brewing when they gave Mr. Dylan the Legion of Honor, France's highest prize. Zlatko Marić, M-A-R-I-C, the Secretary General of the Council, announced in November 2012 that his group had filed a complaint with the French government. That complaint led to the current charges. What we're going to do throughout most of this program is to fill in some of the historical background about the Ustashi, and we're going to start by excerpting a portion of For the Record program number 48, titled Germany, the U.S., and Croatia. This was recorded in the fall of 1995.
In the World War II period, the Yugoslavian ethnic federation was broken apart when Croatian separatists basically allied themselves with the armies of Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy, and after the German invasion of Yugoslavia on April 10th of 1941, the brutal Croatian state proceeded to liquidate hundreds of thousands of Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies. Indeed, some 700,000 Serbs were slaughtered by the Ustashi. What we're going to do now is to turn to a book called Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America. That book was authored by Howard Blum, and it's published in hardcover by Quadrangle Books of the New York Times Book Company. It's copyright hardcover, the hardcover edition, copyright 1977. In this last couple of segments that we're going to look at, we're going to examine the slaughter that took place in the, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia after the German conquest of that country. Again, Croatia was a German client state during World War II. And what we're going to look at is the Minister of the Interior's extermination program. That fellow was named Andrija Artukovic, A-N-D-R-I-J-A is his first name. A-R-T-U-K-O-V-I-C. His nickname was the Himmler of the Balkans, and as we're going to see, the slaughter that was visited upon Jews, Serbs, and Gypsies during World War II by Artukovic and the Ustashi is one of the things that helped set the stage for the retaliation to the brutality that the Serbs have joined in the current war in Yugoslavia. Reading from Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. 5 days after the proclamation of the, quote, independent, unquote, state of Croatia, Pavlic, that's Ante Pavlic, the head of state, and Artukovic, accompanied by German and Italian troops, led a contingent of 200 armed and uniformed Ustashi soldiers through the streets of Zagreb. They had returned, finally triumphant, to take control. Immediately, a Nazi-sponsored cabinet was announced. Pavlic as chief of state, and his number two man, the interior minister Andriy Artukovic. The decade of exile was finally over. For years, power had been the obsession. Now, as independent Croatia realized a new, more terrible obsession would take its place, the complete and permanent institutionalization of this power. The ferocious brutality that powerless exile had masked, Ustashi rule would quickly expose. During this first summer alone, an estimated 180,000 Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies would be slaughtered. The man directing this genocide was Andriy Artukovic. Skipping down. But legislation was not a sufficient solution to the, quote, Jewish question, unquote. The, quote, decisive and healthy grasp, unquote, which Artukovic boasted about to the Sabor, came about in the form of decree, and it's all in Roman numerals, I'm not even going to bother trying to decipher it. This law, signed by Artukovic, legalized the establishment of 20 concentration camps. The camps were controlled directly by Artukovic. It was the intelligence service, security service, and Ustashi police units, specifically under the command of the Minister of the Interior, which organized the mass arrests and supervised the exterminations. Jasenovac, J-A-S-E-N-O-V-A-C, a former brickyard, was transformed under the personal direction of Artukovic into the largest Croatian extermination camp. Artukovic, working with the assistance of Adolf Eichmann, supervised the conversion of the brick kilns into ovens where thousands of Serbs and Jews were burned alive. Death at these camps, though, was not just by anonymous fire. The Ustashi, more so than even the Gestapo, demanded a more personal involvement in their evil. The Ustashi murderers killed their victims with an atavistic passion, throat slashings, eye gougings, tongue extractions, axe decapitations, and disembowelments. All were common ways of death for, quote, enemies of the state, unquote. The Ustashi seemed to lust after barbarism, personally challenging each other to respond more wildly to Pavlic's, quote, call to blood, unquote. At Jasenovac, contests were conducted to see which Ustashi could execute the fastest with his graviso, a long, curve-bladed knife. That's G-R-A-V-I-S-O. Petar Brzica was the champion. His graviso cut through 1,300 throats in a single night. That's, again, some of the historical background to what is going on currently in what used to be Yugoslavia. One of the reasons why the Serbs have reacted as forcibly as they have, and indeed, the situation there is far, far more complex than we have been told, although certainly what the Serb excesses are not to be excused. They are at least, they have been matched by the excesses of the Croatians, and the coverage of that conflict has been heavily, heavily biased.
Following the end of the Cold War and part and parcel to the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, both the United States and Germany, as well as the Vatican, backed what in effect was a restoration to a large extent of the Ustashi government from World War II. Although there is a cosmetic face, they officially ban a lot of Ustashi practices. In fact, it is pretty much a restoration of the Ustashi in substance. We're going to go back to For the Record program number 48, again from the fall of 1995, and we're going to listen about the role of Ustashi in the Republican Party, the overlapping League of Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, which was originally the Committee of Subjugated Nations when it was formed by Adolf Hitler in 1943. You're going to hear about the role of Ustashi in Australia and the significance of the April 10th holiday, something we will come back to later on in this program.
We are going to be turning, for our information, to a very important book entitled The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. That book was co-authored by John Loftus, L-O-F-T-U-S, a former military officer and Justice Department investigator with the Office of Special Investigations, in charge with investigating Nazi war criminals in the United States, and also Mark Ahrens, an Australian investigator. The book was published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press in 1994. In this particular discussion of the fascist element in the Republican Party and how it came to get into the United States, we're going to examine several names which loom large in post-World War II American politics. The godfather of the fascist freedom fighter program, as the authors term this, and also the importation of fascists and Nazi collaborators into the United States to act as ethnic leaders, and as we shall see, these became an important element of the Republican Party. The godfather of that was Alan Dulles. The actual importing of the Nazi war criminals and the political recruitment program was run by Richard Nixon, later, of course, President of the United States. As we shall see later, one of Nixon's cronies in helping to formalize the participation of this Nazi element of the Republican Party in the early 1970s was George Bush, then head of the Republican National Committee. Later, as we saw in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show, Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign, Bush utilized many of these same elements for his 1988 campaign. As we are going to see also, the spokesperson for the Office of Policy Coordination and the spokesperson for the Crusade of Freedom, under whose auspices the Fascist Freedom Fighter Program and the domestic Nazi resettlement program took place, was Ronald Reagan, later, of course, President of the United States, with George Bush as Vice President. As we shall see also, one of the key officials involved with the Fascist Freedom Fighter Program and the importation of these Nazis and war criminals to serve as a political element in the Republican Party was none other than William Casey, who later, of course, became Ronald Reagan's campaign director and was Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence for most of Ronald Reagan's administrations. Of the importation of Nazis and fascist collaborators, and in particular the Croatians, into the Republican Party, the authors write as follows. By the way, also note very carefully the April 10th holiday. That is a Croatian fascist holiday that celebrates the Third Reich's invasion of Yugoslavia in World War II and the consequent establishment of the, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia. Loftus and Ahrens write as follows in The Secret War Against the Jews. As chairman of the Republican National Committee from 1972 to 1974, Bush may have been one of those who knew that there was something politically explosive about the Vatican-Nazi connection, especially as it applied to the Croatians. The Croatian connection to Republican electioneering was no minor scandal, no mere footnote to the 1940s. The Croatian Nazis reached to the very heart of the Republican Party's 1972 campaign to re-elect Richard Nixon as President of the United States. Just about the time that Bush was taking over the job as party chief, the U.S. State Department gave the Australian government a briefing on the role of the Croatian Nazis in American politics. David Sadleir, S-A-D-L-E-I-R, who is now the Director General of the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, equivalent to the head of the FBI or Britain's MI5, met with one of his American counterparts. Sadleir then wrote a long memo on the Nixon administration's sensitive handling of Nazis among the Republican Party's Eastern European emigre supporters. Sadleir had been told in strictest confidence that in the United States, the fascists had to be coddled because the, quote, emigre vote was important to several municipal, state, and federal office bearers. Accordingly, the Nixon administration needed to exercise care in its handling of extremist groups. As the memo makes explicit, there is no doubt that Nazis were the, quote, extremist groups that were so, quote, important, unquote, to the success of the Republican Party's election campaigns. Although Bush is not mentioned, it is clear from Sadleir's memo that the Republican leadership had taken precautions to hide its campaign association with fascist groups, particularly the Croatians. Sadleir was told by his State Department counterpart that, quote, prominent, unquote, federal, state, and municipal American politicians were discreetly advised by the Nixon administration to stay away from Croatian gatherings on April 10th because that was the day they celebrated Hitler's establishment of Ante Pavlović's, quote, puppet state of Croatia, unquote, an artificial nation under the complete control of Nazi Germany. There are grounds to suspect that George Bush may have been among those who knew of Nixon's Nazi secret. In the first place, Bush was one of the few people whom Nixon trusted completely. In the second place, Bush's position as head of the Republican Party made him the logical person to take control of the program to warn other Republicans that they must avoid attending Croatian functions on April 10th. While there is no direct evidence that Bush had personal knowledge of Croatian fascist activities, at least before he became CIA director, it seems unlikely that Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee, could have remained out of the loop entirely. The Croatian election connection almost became a scandal during his tenure as party leader. In 1973, a large number of Australian intelligence documents were tabled for parliamentary debate and thus became open to public access. Buried in this largely unread stack of counterintelligence, police, and immigration files was a copy of Sadler's secret briefing memo. The Nixon administration was distraught. No wonder Angleton was publicly furious with the Australians. The Croatian, quote, crown jewels, unquote, were a potential political bombshell. Unfortunately, the indolent American press missed the story completely. The truth was quite sordid. With the help of the Dulles Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. The cover-up had been going on for a long time before Angleton censored the Vatican files, but the Australians inadvertently had let a tiny corner of the story out of the bag. Although we explore the Republican-Nazi connections in chapters 10 and 13, it is important for the reader to understand the size of the scandal that Angleton was trying to bury. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language-speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist, quote, freedom fighters, unquote, during the 1950s, and the leadership of the party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee, quote, displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. As vice president, he even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. After a long, long journey, the Croatian Nazis had found a new home in the United States, where they had reestablished their networks. In 1968, Nixon promised that if he won the presidential election, he would create a permanent ethnic council within the Republican Party. Previously, the ethnic division was allowed to surface only during presidential campaigns. Nixon's promise was carried out after the 1972 election during Bush's tenure as chairman of the Republican National Committee. The Croatian Ustashes became an integral part of the campaign structure of Republican politics, along with several other fascist organizations. Shortly after Australia released its Croatian memo, Nixon was forced to resign as a result of the Watergate scandal. At the same time, Bush was transferred from his post as head of the Republican National Committee to the CIA. According to the, quote, old spies, unquote, George Bush, a very likable fellow, was appointed head of the CIA partly because his good reputation in Congress would help to fend off any more congressional inquiries, particularly Elizabeth Holtzman's ongoing investigation of Nazis in the United States. The last thing Bush or the Republican Party needed was an expose of the very origins of Angleton's Croatian Nazi connection. By the way, that refers to James Jesus Angleton, longtime CIA counterintelligence chief. Continuing. There was a real risk in the 1970s that the congressional investigations of Nixon might collide with the congressional investigations of Nazis. Bush was sent to the CIA to ensure that Nixon's garbage remained buried. As we're going to see now, when Nixon became president, he formally coalesced this Eastern European fascist group into an element of the Republican Party. 20 years after the birth of, returning to the secret war against the Jews, 20 years after the birth of Israel, the Nazis were coming out of the closet in the United States. One of the most prominent Eastern European fascists was Laszlo Pastor, P-A-S-Z-T-O-R, the founding chair of Nixon's Republican Heritage Group's council. During World War II, Pastor was a diplomat in Berlin representing the Arrow Cross government of Nazi Hungary, which supervised the extermination of the Jewish population. Skipping down. Pastor labored on the fringes of the Republican Party's ethnic division during the Eisenhower administration, but the loyal fascists were always dropped as soon as the election campaign was over. The ethnic division was allowed to be active only during presidential campaigns. In 1968, Nixon changed all that. According to Pastor, Nixon personally promised to establish a permanent ethnic organization in the Republican Party if he became president. Nixon kept his promise. As discussed in Chapter 5, the 1972 secret Australian memo revealed that the Nixon administration had discovered that fascist groups were useful to get out the ethnic votes in several key states. Nixon needed the Nazi vote to avoid another Dewey debacle. Just a few more votes would have made all the difference in Nixon's race against Kennedy in 1960. In several key states, the Eastern European vote could provide the margin for victory in 1968. The road to temptation was clear, and after Nixon won, he approved Pastor's appointment as chief organizer of the Ethnic Council. Not surprisingly, Pastor's, quote, choices for filling emigre slots as the council was being formed included various Nazi collaborationist organizations, unquote. The former fascists were coming out of the closet in droves, and as we shall see, one of the people who was instrumental, apparently, according to many of the sources that Loftus and Ahrens relied on, one of the people instrumental in helping to cement this permanent Nazi division of the Republican Party, and I mean that quite literally, including the Croatian Ustashi, was none other than George Bush, returning to the secret war against the Jews. The most intriguing of Bush's early connections was to Richard Nixon, who as vice president had supervised Allen Dulles' covert planning for the Bay of Pigs. For years, it has been rumored that Dulles' client, George Bush's father, was one of the Republican leaders who recruited Nixon to run for Congress and later convinced Eisenhower to take him on as vice president. There is no doubt that the two families were close. George Bush described Nixon as his, quote, mentor, unquote. Nixon was a Bush supporter in his very first tilt at politics during his unsuccessful run for the Senate in 1964 and turned out again when he entered the House 2 years later. Skipping down, it was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the, quote, ethnic emigres a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States. It seems clear that George Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee in 1972, must have known who these, quote, ethnics, unquote, really were. Columns by Jack Anderson and others had already made it clear in 1971 that Nixon was a little too close to the fascist groups. The Nazis for Nixon problem was one of those scandals that Bush inherited when he took over the Republican National Committee. Skipping down, as head of the Republican National Committee, it seems likely that Bush did have, quote, full knowledge, unquote, as did Richard Johnson of the State Department, that the ethnic fascists were being coddled because the ethnic groups were useful to get out the vote in several key states. As we shall see, or as we're about to see, in addition to Richard Nixon and George Bush, both of them obviously, eventually presidents of the United States, in addition to Allen Dulles, later CIA director like George Bush, two other key politicians were involved with this very same program. One of these is Ronald Reagan. Skipping down. In the U.S., in a footnote in the Secret War Against the Jews, in the U.S. National Archives, there is 1950s newsreel footage of a young Ronald Reagan asking for donations to the Crusade for Freedom. This organization was later acknowledged as a covert front for the distribution of funds to the OPC's network of emigre fascists. See John Loftus, The Belarus Secret, Alfred A. Knopf, 1982, pages 107 and 141. In essence, Reagan's public crusade raised less than 1% of the funds. The rest came from CIA covert accounts that had been lauded through the State Department. The money was distributed to Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, and the Institute of Russian Research in Germany. All three organizations had Nazi war criminals on the payroll, as CBS's 60 Minutes program documented in 1982. So Ronald Reagan was, of course, one of the spokespersons for the Crusade for Freedom, under the auspices of which many of these Nazi war criminals were put to work for the U.S. government, and some of them imported under the Richard Nixon-supervised Nazi resettlement program in the U.S. One of the people critically involved along with Richard Nixon and Allen Dulles and Ronald Reagan in this operation was William Casey, who later, of course, became Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and CIA director. In another footnote from The Secret War Against the Jews, we find Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor of Dulles' recruits. Confidential interviews, former members of the OPC, information was from confidential interviews with former members of the OPC and members of the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So again, we see three eventual presidents of the United States and three eventual directors of the CIA, the presidents being Nixon, Reagan, and Bush, the CIA directors being Bush, Dulles, and Casey, being involved with this particular program to import Nazi war criminals into the United States and put them to work for the government as well as the intelligence services. The Croatian Ustashes were one of the key elements in that particular program. With the Eastern European fascists and collaborators having formed such an important part of the Republican Party, and indeed with people ranging from Richard Nixon and Alan Dulles to George Bush, Ronald Reagan, and William Casey being deeply involved with these elements, including the Croatian Ustaši, it is not surprising that the policy bias, as well as media bias on the part of the United States towards the Serbs and on behalf of the Croatians, should be manifest in the way that it is.
That again from For the Record program number 48 from the fall of 1995. All of the programs that are excerpted in this broadcast and a wealth of other material available on the Spitfire List website at www.spitfirelist.com. It has my entire life's work, plus a library of old anti-fascist books, and a remarkable volume of contribution by others as well, including a collaborator who posts under the name of Terrafractal, PTERRAFRACTYL. We will examine more about the Ustaši, past and present, in Side 2. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 766, Bob Dylan versus the Ustaši. This is being recorded on December 22nd of the year 2013. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.